Welcome to Going Further and Higher, Shakespeare Martineau's podcast in which we discuss topical or indeed long-running themes in higher and further education. My name is Smita Jamdar and I'm partner and head of education at Shakespeare Martineau. In today's episode, I'm joined by a fellow member of the education team, Geraldine Swanton, to look at the appeal decision in the very sad case of Natasha Abrahart against the University of Bristol. Listeners will by now most likely be familiar with the facts of this tragic case, but to summarise, Natasha enrolled on an undergraduate programme in physics in 2016, initially progressing well academically and with no indication that she had any form of disability. During her second year, which was the 2017-18 academic year, she was required as part of her course to give interviews lasting up to 25 minutes after conducting laboratory experiments. She was also required to participate in a second year conference in which groups of students were to give PowerPoint presentations for up to 12 minutes, followed by questions for 3 minutes. The interviews and the oral presentations formed part of the university's formal assessment of Natasha's academic performance. And she didn't cope with the interviews and oral presentations at all well. She either said nothing during the interviews or she didn't turn up for them, and she received 0 marks accordingly. Her mental health deteriorated as a result, and on the 30th of April 2018, when she would have been expected to make an oral presentation at a conference with fellow students, she died by suicide. The medical evidence, which was adduced during the original county court hearing, agreed that Natasha suffered from severe depression with prominent anxiety features, as well as social anxiety disorder, which could have been exacerbated by the fear of performing in oral assessments. The appeal by the university was against the county court's judgment that the university had discriminated against Natasha under the disability provisions of the Equality Act and thereby contributed to her death. And the university failed on all 7 grounds of appeal. Natasha's father also failed in his cross appeal against the county court's findings that the university had no duty of care to Natasha in the specific circumstances of this case. So, Jerry, I've got a number of questions for you, which I think listeners would find very useful to hear your thoughts on. I think just to set the context a little bit, it's important for us all to understand, isn't it, what the High Court's jurisdiction was in this appeal? What was it looking at?
The High Court in this case acted as a form of judicial review of the County Court decision. So the High Court didn't conduct a retrial, but simply scrutinised the County Court judge's decision to assess whether it was reasonable for him to conclude as he did on the facts presented and the arguments by both cases.
So it's quite a limited scope of review in some ways and very dependent on reviewing what the county court had done based on the evidence. So just picking out then a few of the aspects of the appeal that I think are probably very generally applicable to universities and indeed to colleges. What did the High Court decide in relation to competence standards? Because that's often a key area of contest, isn't it, when we're looking at disability discrimination?
Yes, it is. And the primary issue for consideration by the High Court was the duty to make reasonable adjustments, which, of course, does not apply to competence standards. And they are any academic or other standard applied for the purposes of determining whether a person has a particular level of competence or ability. Now, the university sought to argue that the assessment of Natasha's ability to explain lab work was an essential core competency of a professional scientist, and therefore there was no duty to adjust the oral assessments. However, the High Court agreed with the County Court that, in fact, what was really being tested was knowledge and not the ability to engage in oral communication. And therefore, if what was tested was simply knowledge and the method by which that knowledge was being assessed caused Natasha's substantial disadvantage as a result of her disability, then it would have been reasonable for the university to assess her by another means, for example, by written responses rather than oral responses.
And we know, don't we, Jerry, from various cases we've dealt with, that that judgment around whether something is a competence standard or simply a method of assessing a competence standard is difficult for universities to pinpoint. And there can be kind of quite a lot of entrenched belief that something is a competent standard. But what this judgment really says is the court will scrutinise quite carefully those arguments to look at, you know, exactly what it is that's being assessed. Moving on to reasonable adjustments then. You mentioned, obviously, that the competent standard discussion took place as part of a discussion around the duty to make reasonable adjustments. And I think there were a couple of features of the discussion that I think are, again, quite important for universities and colleges to reflect on. So the first is the extent to which institutions are justified in insisting on expert medical evidence to underpin a claim for disability-related adjustments. So what did the court say about expert evidence or medical evidence?
I suppose the issue turned upon, firstly, before we get to medical evidence, what the university knew about Natasha and her disability. And its claim was that it didn't have sufficient expertise or any expert evidence to be able to know anything or to be able to do anything. And so it was not prepared to make any adjustments unless and until it had relevant medical evidence. And so the issue was, did it know that Natasha was disabled? And I think the county court concluded that actually they knew she was suffering from some injury to her mental health around October of 2017 in her second year, and it was connected to lab interviews. Their knowledge increased as time went on. Her behaviour was described as objectively bizarre and that there was something amiss in December 2017. And there was some suggestion by an academic that she should be sent for referral to the Disability Support Service in as late as December. So the university's knowledge of her impairment increased, notwithstanding that there was no medical evidence. And it really, it had accepted that Natasha had mental health problems and was genuinely unable to cope with oral assessments. So the duty to make adjustments was engaged once it was really apparent that there was a genuine problem with her mental health and which was adversely affecting her ability to engage in oral assessments. And there was a failure, therefore, to make adjustments to the assessment methods, notwithstanding the fact that there was no medical evidence.
And separately to the question of what kind of evidence an institution might need in order to make adjustments, the court also looked at the fact that there was an established process within the university to secure those kind of adjustments, which Natasha hadn't followed. And what did the court say about this idea that if you don't follow the due process, that somehow, you know, means that reasonable adjustments cannot be made or should not be made?
Yeah. So we're dealing here in a case of very obvious impairment, a pathological fear of oral assessments, which it's not, you don't need to have an, you know, some kind of clinical diagnosis. Secondly, in the courts, both High Court and County Court concluded that the university was not justified in refusing to take any steps until it had an assessment from the Disability Support Services. And the big problem here, according to the High Court, was that the university tended to rely on its own regulations and policies that says, oh, you must have a disability support assessment before we can do anything. And the problem with that was their own regulations and policies were not law, and by inference, they could be adjusted or waived to prevent Natasha from suffering substantial disadvantage because she had a very clear and obvious impairment.
Absolutely. And again, that's not an uncommon set of sort of facts, is it, that we see in the cases we deal with where, you know, institutions often are waiting for that process to be followed before really applying their minds to what could be done based on what they see going on with the individual. The next sort of aspects of disability discrimination I just wanted to look at was the idea of discrimination arising from a disability, because that was another finding against the university, wasn't it? So if you could just remind listeners what the definition of discrimination arising from a disability is.
It's quite broad, this definition, and this type of discrimination arises when a university treats a disabled student unfavorably because of something related to or in consequence of their disability, and the university cannot show that the treatment is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. In other words, if the university cannot objectively justify the treatment. Now, further, this discrimination will not occur if a university doesn't know, doesn't have actual knowledge of the disability, or if it could not reasonably have known that the student was disabled. And so the unfavorable treatment in this case was the marking down of Natasha for her oral assessment. So the issue arose as to when did they know that she was disabled? In other words, when did she have an impairment that had a long-term and adverse effect on her ability to do the oral assessments?
And there was a disagreement, wasn't there, between the county court and the county court's findings and what the High Court concluded. So what was the original decision around when the university knew or should have known Natasha had a disability?
Yes, there was a slight disparity. The county court's view was that both High Court and county court said they should have known, and they in fact did know. The county court said the knowledge occurred in and around late 2017, and the High Court concluded that actually the university didn't know that her impairment was long term until around February of 2018, and the second term of her second year. But both courts accepted and concluded that they knew that she was impaired and disabled. Just a slight disparity on the dates.
Yeah, and it's astonishing, isn't it, how these themes just keep coming up again and again, especially when you've got people who develop conditions whilst they're enrolled, that question of at what point the duty to make adjustments, the duty to, you know, protect from discrimination arises because of that not knowing right at the beginning how long-term something like this can be. And you know, we know that's always going to be a challenge for universities to make that call. Before we go on and sort of talk a bit more generally about what lessons universities might learn, the other aspects of the case that I thought might be worth just reflecting on is the decision in relation to indirect discrimination. So again, Jerry, what did the High Court conclude about the county court's decision on indirect discrimination?
I suppose very briefly, just to explain indirect discrimination, it's where a university applies an ostensibly neutral policy, practice or criterion. It puts people with a particular disability at a disadvantage. It puts the individual student at that disadvantage. And again, the university cannot justify this practice, criterion or provision. This indirect discrimination really wasn't a central issue. There was a very technical discussion about indirect discrimination and justification based on the actual arguments advanced by Natasha's father and by the university. And I think really what's important from the discussion is really the lessons learned that, look, methods of assessments and non-essential competence standards could amount to indirect discrimination depending on the disability and the circumstances of the particular case. I think that's just the lesson to extract it, rather than the technical arguments engaged in the High Court.
I think we're all grateful to not get bogged down in the technical arguments on that one. So moving on then to the sort of broader lessons that could be learned from this, as I say, incredibly sad case. So I think, firstly, there are things that we can learn, can't we, about what evidence of disabilities can institutions reasonably ask for? So what do you think of the key points there?
As you know, Smita, disability or any Equality Act case is very fact specific. So I think we need to keep in mind that this case was about a clear and obvious disability that needed no expert diagnosis or skilled assessment. Its manifestation was its own evidence and required a simple response by the relevant academic department. Now, many disabilities are hidden. They're complex. and do require expertise to identify their particular effects. So it's not unreasonable in those circumstances for a university to request medical evidence or to require a student to undergo an assessment of needs.
And so it follows from that that the requiring medical evidence can't itself be a discriminatory act as a general principle. But is there anything that institutions need to think about in terms of when they ask for it and how they ask for it?
Yes, it won't be discriminatory in all cases, but possibly in cases of clear and obvious impairment. So they need to think, you know, what do they know? What, you know, is this something very obvious? Is it pathological almost? And is there a simple step the university could take to ameliorate the effects of this obvious impairment?
I think the other area that probably lessons do need to be learned from, but it's not straightforward to learn those lessons, is about the point that the court made, which is that, you know, requiring all students to go through that process of billing via disability services or whatever the institution calls that service centre may not be justified if there is some really obvious signs that the person needs some adjustments. And so that's kind of suggesting that duty to make reasonable adjustments might have to be operated quite locally, frontline staff making those decisions. And that's not straightforward either, is it?
No, it's not. And I have a lot of sympathy for particularly academic staff who are now required to, you know, identify a disability when something is very obvious and have a very streamlined process, because it could be discriminatory to require a student to go through an onerous process to get the adjustments to which they are entitled. And another interesting point of this case was that if you fail in your duty to make reasonable adjustments, you are almost certainly going to lose any claim or any ability to defend a claim of unfavourable treatment arising in consequence of a disability, because you can never justify unfavourable treatment if you failed to make a reasonable adjustment.
And obviously some of the justifications that universities typically would rely on is, well, this is necessary to maintain academic standards, it's necessary to make an accurate assessment of someone's academic ability. But as you're saying, if you haven't gone through that exercise of making reasonable adjustments, even those potentially powerful arguments about why you might have to treat somebody unfavorably, where it's not a competent standard, but you know how you're choosing to assess it, is not going to wash because you haven't done the legwork. I think what this is saying, and what is the unfortunate case of what is the unfortunate result of a lot of cases, is that this puts more responsibility on frontline staff, academic staff, people who may not traditionally have had these responsibilities around making decisions about adjustments. And so what do we think about how they might be better supported in having to make those judgments?
I mean, I think perhaps training is a key issue. Just understanding the definition of disability, really appreciating that it's not about a clinical or medical diagnosis, it's about an impairment which prevents a student from engaging in some of the day-to-day activities required of students. So understanding the definition, understanding the difference between competent standards and methods of assessment to be able to differentiate the two. It might be a useful exercise for academic staff to identify in their courses what are indispensable learning outcomes from those that are merely desirable to avoid indirect discrimination. So, you know, yes, it does mean that academic staff have to have a greater awareness of the duties to disabled students under the Equality Act.
And I think also one of the things that I've certainly come across in some of the cases I've advised on is where academic staff sometimes don't really know who to go to if they're not sure what to do. So they don't necessarily have a clear line of sight to the disability services team. There's sometimes difficulties in communication between those teams, and all that then just puts that extra barrier in the place of being able to make quick decisions to say, yes, we can agree to this, or we can't without further evidence or for good reason, you know, agree to these things. So I think looking at those information flows and communication flows within the different teams or between the different teams is probably going to be helpful as well. Final question then. Of course, one of the areas that this case originally looked at, and what I think is probably the one that, you know, most exercises public debate on the case, is around the question of the duty of care. I mean, actually, as we've explored, there is a lot in this case about, you know, now established kind of principles that would benefit students in this situation, even before we get onto the idea of a broader duty of care. But where are we on that question of duty of care? The High Court didn't really deal with the issue, did it?
No, it absolutely refused to consider it. And rightly, in my view, because as the High Court judge said, look, the negligence claim in the county court was not properly argued by Natasha's father. And also, the county court judge's approach was rather dubious, because what he seemed to say was, he concluded that there was no duty to protect Natasha from herself. There was no kind of welfare duty on the part of the university. By having welfare and student support services did not automatically mean that the assumed responsibility for her welfare or for protecting her from herself. But what he then said in a rather unguarded and frankly irrational moment was, he said, but if there was such a duty, the university is in breach. And what the county court judge did there was he took the conclusions reached under the Equality Act and then just simply applied them in that dubious way to the very complex common law issue of negligence. And he really couldn't do that. So the negligence claim, A, wasn't properly pleaded by Natasha's parents, and there was no reasoned judgment on the part of on the part of the county court judge that it could have been breached had a duty existed. So we aren't any further. At the moment, the status quo remains, and that is that there is no general duty to protect someone from themselves.
Great. Well, as always, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts, Gerry. I should mention to regular listeners that Gerry retires in April. And so this is her final podcast, which is a very sad moment. I wanted to thank you, Gerry, for all the insight and wisdom that you've shared with us over many episodes. Thanks also to all of you for listening. We hope you'll join us next time. And don't forget to hit the subscribe button. If you like what you've heard, please do leave a review. But until next time, it's goodbye from me. And
it's a valedictory goodbye from me. And it's been a great pleasure advising the university sector and education in general. So I'll miss you all very much.
Thank you.
Bye.